Hey, here's something you should know. Some experts estimate that up to 77% of the population has some level of speaking anxiety. I actually thought it was higher than that. Strong communication is a critical skill for success, which is why I'd like to recommend a podcast I know you're going to love called Think Fast, Talk Smart, produced by the folks at Stanford Graduate School of Business. Think Fast, Talk Smart is the number one career podcast in over 95 countries, and here's why. Each week, Stanford lecturer Matt Abrahams, who, by the way, has been on this podcast a couple of times, Matt sits down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you improve all kinds of skills, from making small talk that leaves a big impression, keeping your nerves in check while speaking in front of crowds. I mean, there's a reason this show has over 42 million downloads and counting. You'll hear from people like neuroscientist Andrew Huberman on how to manage speaking anxiety, speechwriter and best-selling author Daniel Pink on how to take risks in your communication, and psychologist Kelly McGonigal on how to harness that nervous energy to fuel powerful presentations. All that and so much more is available on Think Fast, Talk Smart. So, what are you waiting for? Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube, and you can tell them I sent you. Today on Something You Should Know, brilliant ways to feel more confident in situations where you feel just the opposite. Then, should you start your own side business? A lot of people are.
So for anybody listening, like if your whole life you've gotten a paycheck, and then all of a sudden you start one of these little side projects, you know, you wake up, you know, a month from now and you have a PayPal notification that a stranger sent you money. It feels really, really good.
Also, why you're more likely to trust an attractive person just because of their looks. And the fascinating way the weather is forecast and how meteorologists are getting better and better.
Their forecasts have gotten better by about a decade over the last 50 years, which is to say that a five-day forecast today is as good as a four-day forecast was 10 years ago, is as good as a three-day forecast 20 years ago, or most staggeringly, as good as a one-day forecast was 40 years ago.
All this today on Something You Should Know. If you employ people, you know that finding the right person to fill a job opening can be daunting. And you know, most people I know who run a business don't really have a proven system to do this. It can be real hit or miss, which is why if you're hiring, you need Indeed. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Indeed is a whole hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates and find them fast. So what I love about Indeed is when you use it, you get this feeling of confidence that, yeah, this is the way to find the right people. You're not winging it or just sorting through resumes hoping to find someone. And Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from you. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. There's so many reasons to use Indeed, and there are so many reasons not to do this on your own. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/something. Just go to Indeed.com/something right now. That helps to support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/something. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Something you should know. Fascinating intel, the world's top experts, and practical advice you can use in your life. Today, Something You Should Know with Mike Carruthers.
Hi. In the last couple of weeks, we've gotten a lot of really nice reviews on Apple Podcasts and some of the other podcast platforms. And if you're one of the people who left one of those reviews or any of the reviews, thank you for doing that. On Apple Podcasts, we're over 4,800 ratings and reviews, and we're trying to get to 5,000. So if you have a moment, head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a rating and review. It only takes a second, and it really helps us out. First up today, we're going to talk about the sun and your skin. While most dermatologists and moms agree that you should always put sunscreen on when you go outside, the topic is actually quite controversial. There are plenty of people who cite research that shows that sunscreen does little to prevent skin cancer. In fact, in the last 35 years, as people have increased the use of sunscreen and avoided sun exposure, the rate of melanoma, which is the deadly kind of skin cancer, the rate of melanoma has actually tripled, which has led some people to believe that sunscreen may actually be contributing to the problem somehow. Now, while scientists hash all this out, one thing research is pretty clear on is that your diet can help prevent skin cancer for sure. A diet that includes a lot of fruit, vegetables, fish, and herbs seems to have a very protective effect against melanoma. In regions of the world where people eat this way, the rate of skin cancer is substantially lower than it is here in the U.S. And that is something you should know. If you want to make more money, you could get a second job, or you could drive for Uber or Lyft, or you could start your own side business. I'm not necessarily talking about taking the full entrepreneur plunge, but doing something on the side while you keep your current job, at least for a while. There's a name for this. It's called a side hustle. And there are some strategies to use that will help you start your side hustle successfully. Here to discuss this is the guru of the side hustle, Chris Guillebeau. Chris is the author of two books on this topic, and his latest is 100 Side Hustles, Unexpected Ideas for Making Extra Money Without Quitting Your Day Job. He's also host of the daily podcast, Side Hustle School. Hey, Chris.
Hello, Michael.
So it seems that people have been talking a lot lately about side hustles. Maybe that's in large part because of you, but it's not really a new concept, is it?
I think side hustle, the term, has been around since 1950-something, but obviously in the past decade or so, a lot more people are using it in different ways. And I think for some people, side hustle just refers to a part-time job or to participating in the gig economy, you know, driving for Lyft or Uber or whatever. I try to look at it from the lens of a side hustle is an income-generating project that you start without quitting your day job. So ideally, it's not just, you know, doing something for somebody else, but actually creating a bit of an asset for yourself so that you have more security, more options as you move forward with the rest of your career.
So if you're thinking in terms of generating more income with a side hustle, where does the thought process begin? What are you trying to do here?
Yeah. A great way to begin is by looking at your skills. So instead of the old, you know, follow your passion thing, it's follow your skills. You know, make an inventory of your skills. Write down all the things that you're good at, not just what you trained for in your traditional career, not just what you have, you know, work experience with, but maybe even hobbies or some kind of topic that you have specialized knowledge in. Ask your friends as well, because sometimes your friends can see things, you know, that you don't. So pay attention, start with those skills, you know, and then from the skill, it's like, well, most of us, you know, are actually kind of passionate about the things that we are good at. So there is a connection there, but starting from the skills is more helpful. And then, you know, the next step is, okay, well, you know, I've got this skill. It is helpful to someone else. How can I then create some kind of offer from that? And that offer could be a service. It could be a product. Could be reselling or something else. But, you know, going from an idea to an offer would be the next logical step.
Where do you think people go wrong? Is this a pivotal spot right here?
Yeah, I think there are a few pivotal spots. I mean, first one is, you know, the first mishap, let's say, is overthinking, believing that you have to, you know, have an 80-page business plan, believing that, you know, it's going to take a year for you to get ready. You're going to have to, you know, cash out your life savings. I mean, you know, all those things are things I advocate people don't do. So, you know, overthinking it, maybe, you know, failing or neglecting to go from idea to action. You know, the majority of people, if you stop them on the street, you know, they have a business idea of some kind, but they're not necessarily doing something about it. So, you know, just even taking small steps to move forward, maybe also getting overwhelmed, or I often hear this objection of like, I have too many ideas, you know, I don't know which idea to choose. I think those are some common pitfalls.
What's the answer to that? If you have too many good ideas,
yeah,
how do you choose one?
The principle here to remember is, and people find this, you know, oddly relieving, the principle is you're not making a life commitment here. You're not choosing your life partner. You know, this decision of like, what kind of income generating project am I going to work on for the next 30 days? You know, it doesn't have very high stakes in terms of if it goes wrong, or let's just say it doesn't work out. Well, you're not spending a ton of money. Hopefully you've learned something, you know, along the way, and then you can apply that to whatever the next idea is, you know? And so ultimately, if you're really stuck, you know, you should just pick something. But if you're not quite at that point, then maybe it's a question of your goals. You know, like, what am I trying to accomplish with this project? Because some people are just trying to make some extra money, and that's great. You know, other people are trying to get out of student debt or, you know, some other significant debt. Other people really are trying to replicate the income that they have from their traditional job. They eventually want to leave that job. So it really depends on, like, what are you trying to do, you know, with this process. And that's probably why I love this whole thing, because, you know, there's lots of different roads, you know, to a similar outcome of having more security and freedom.
And that's your thing, right? 30 days. You should be up and running in 30 days.
Yeah. I mean, and to be totally honest, it is somewhat arbitrary. Like, some people obviously can take longer, and some people, you know, might go gung-ho and be done in 14 days. But I think the principle is, like, you know, don't spend a ton of time on it. Really focus on, like, what is the minimum kind of offer that I can create? And how can I actually put something out to get real world feedback from it? Because that's the information that ultimately you need to be able to make the next decision on whether you're going to pursue this idea further or whether you're going to try something else. So the idea is just, you know, move quickly.
So let's take it out of the abstract and talk about some real side hustles here and some people that have done it that might whet people's appetite.
So let's talk about problems and solutions. Last night at my book event in Portland, Oregon, I met Brittany Finkel, who's actually in the book, but I hadn't met her before. And her story is she's a buyer for luxury brands. You know, she works for a company, but she has three older sisters, and she'd been part of planning all three of their weddings. And so through that process, she learned that not only wedding dresses are really expensive, but also all the wedding accessories. So you got your veil, your tiara, you know, whatever else the bride or anybody else, you know, wants to wear. So do we really need to spend, you know, hundreds of dollars, sometimes thousands of dollars on that kind of stuff that's only worn once? You know, do you really need to keep all those things for the rest of your life? And so she said, you know, why isn't there a rental market for wedding accessories? Because again, you know, very lightly used one time. And so she decided to create a little business called Happily Ever Borrowed. And with this business, she's using the skills that she has, you know, as a buyer for luxury brands. She made a website, put this offer out, got some press. She's been doing it for about 3 years now. And last year, she made $80,000, you know, from this. And she still has her day job. So $80,000 on the side from this project that's really providing, like, a clear solution to a problem that, in retrospect, everybody's like, well, why didn't somebody else do this? You know, but, you know, for whatever reason, no one did.
Well, but isn't that sometimes a good question to ask? If no one else is doing this, maybe there's no market for this.
Yes, no, that's totally fair as well. So we could take it on the flip side and say, you know, if you have an idea, but you're concerned, you know, that somebody else out there is doing the same thing, it's not actually a huge concern because, you know, as you just kind of suggested the other way around, maybe that actually demonstrates that there is a market, you know, for this thing. And you know, you don't have to come up with an idea that is 100% unique, you know, never been done before. You know, of the stories I tell in my podcast, I would say maybe, you know, 15%, 20% are unique in that way. And others are just, you know, iterations of a different idea.
I wonder, and you would be the guy to ask this, I wonder how often it happens that people come up with an idea for a side hustle and it turns into something else, or it's modified in some significant way from the original idea, that they don't end up actually doing what their original idea was.
Yeah, I would say that's extremely common, probably more than 50%. I mean, I don't know exactly, but I would say, you know, roughly half the people that I talk to, like, they have their idea and they run with it, which they're still going to end up making changes, you know, of some kind along the way. But the other half actually make, you know, very significant changes, end up discarding that project, which I think is actually a good idea in lots of cases. You know, if something isn't working, there's no reason, you know, why you should keep trying it. Like, we have this American value of persistence that I think is kind of mistaught. Because ultimately the predictor of success is not persistence, it's adaptation, you know? And like, you hear these stories about so-and-so failed, you know, 40 times, you know, before he succeeded on the 41st attempt. And whenever I hear that, I'm always like, well, what else could he have been doing? You know, for all those 40 attempts, he could have changed, you know, projects. So that's another reason why people do get hung up, because they try something and it doesn't work and they think that they're a failure rather than understanding, you know, that thing may have given them knowledge or experience to go into something else.
Of course, you write about and highlight and profile the success stories, but I wonder, are they the exception or the rule?
Every success story has failure or mishap or mistakes, you know, or setbacks. You know, I don't know statistically, right? Like how many people attempt this and then give up for whatever reason. But I would always caution people to say, like, if you encounter these setbacks, understand that every successful person encounters setbacks. So the question then is like, how do we deal with that when we encounter it, as opposed to like, how am I going to just avoid that entirely?
What I like about this is that so much of the entrepreneurship idea implies that you need to take the plunge, that you need to really dive in headfirst into the deep end and hope it works. And what you're talking about is a lot less risky. You're starting something quickly, you're starting it small, and if it doesn't work, it's not the end of the world, but at least you tried, because you don't want to be 5-10 years from now or the end of your life looking back wondering, what if I had?
Exactly. I mean, this is that's very similar to something I say pretty much every night on the book tour. I'm like, you know, just imagine your life at some point in the future. You've got this idea. Maybe you're not even sure exactly what the full idea is, but you've got this inkling of something. You got like even a vague desire. Fast forward in your mind, you know, a year from now, 18 months from now, whatever the time period is, and just think about how you will feel if you actually move forward with this and if you actually make progress. And I firmly believe that, you know, if people do move forward, even take the small next step, whatever it is, they're going to feel better than if they didn't. And I actually believe that's true regardless of the outcome. I think it's actually independent of what the actual result is, because just making progress, just taking that step, you know, resolves that what if question in your mind. And as I said, maybe it'll be a big success, maybe it won't. But if it isn't, hopefully it will lead you to something beyond that through that experience.
I want to talk more about some real people, because we've been talking more or less in the abstract, and I think it's the stories of real people that have done this that is so inspiring. I'm speaking with Chris Guillebeau, who's author of the new book, 100 Side Hustles. Are you one of those people who just buys things with whatever credit card you grab out of your wallet? Well, that could be a costly move. NerdWallet, you've heard of NerdWallet. NerdWallet lets you compare credit cards side by side to maximize your spending. So if, for example, you like travel rewards, you can see which credit card gives you better rewards than the credit cards you've got now. Think of what you could do with better rewards. A free flight, room upgrades, who knows? Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and so much more at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Credit is subject to lender approval and terms of each credit card issuer apply.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And so, Chris, let's talk about some real people who have taken the side hustle idea and really run with it.
A story I really like to tell is this guy named Mark from South Carolina, and he goes on vacation to Austin, Texas, walks into an upscale men's store, and sees a candle for sale for $80. And, you know, the first thing he thinks is, well, that's ridiculous, $80 for a candle. And the second thing he thinks is, like, you know, how can I sell those? Like, I want to sell $80 candles. You know, nice work if you can get it. So, you know, he didn't go back to school and get a master's degree in candle making or business or anything else. He went back home and just kind of figured it out. He watched YouTube. You know, he watched YouTube tutorials and just kind of practiced on his own. And then obviously it wasn't just the making of the candles. You know, he applied some marketing to it. He really created this brand called Meeting and Market, which is named for this historic intersection there in Charleston. And now he's selling these candles, you know, on Amazon, making several thousand dollars a month, you know, from them, largely passively. You know, so that's one example. Just really quickly, another one, there's a woman who's a bit older who ended up making this course all about baking sourdough bread. And I think this is so interesting because, like, you know, the first course she made was very, very old school. It was filmed with an iPhone in her kitchen with bad lighting. You know, she's just talking to the camera about baking bread. And for whatever reason, it really went over very well on Udemy. And she ends up making, you know, a second course, a third course, all about baking sourdough bread. Like, she's really kind of owning this niche. And she ended up making something like $80,000, you know, from these courses. And it's so interesting because you think, well, you know, there's all kinds of ways to learn to bake bread. Like, I don't have to buy her course, right? But it seems, you know, that she's able to forge this connection with people enough that, you know, when they stumble upon the trailer or whatever, you know, they find it valuable. And that has completely transformed her life. I mean, this money was like, she actually wasn't very well off, and this was the most money she'd made in a long time, and, you know, was able to put a down payment on the first home she'd ever owned. So, you know, this can be incredibly freeing and bring, you know, so much joy and transformation to people's lives if they take that leap.
I would imagine a big problem for, or a big challenge for people who start a side hustle, is the challenge that any business has, is finding customers, because it's great to have an idea and it's great to be able to make a really shiny something or to have an $80 candle, but it's no good if nobody buys it, if you can't find those people that are likely to buy it, and which takes it into the realm of sales. And a lot of people, when they think about sales and marketing, think, I have no clue.
Right, right. Well, I encourage people to think of marketing essentially as connecting. And it doesn't have to be this cold call situation. I think if you think about it from the front end, like, here's my idea, right from the very beginning, before you get very far along, you need to have an answer to the question, how is this idea going to make money? It's not something that should be, you know, figured out later in the process. So I think in the case of, like, you know, the candle guy, he had wanted to sell something on Amazon. He was reading up a lot about this process of how people ship products to an Amazon warehouse, then they handle fulfillment, et cetera. So he did a lot of research into, like, what's the best way to master that, you know. And there's lots of different approaches, you know, for how you're going to sell, how you're going to ship a product, whether it's digital, whether it's physical, et cetera. So I definitely think that, you know, research is helpful. But if you know, if you have an idea in the beginning of who your ideal customer is, it's going to make a huge difference compared to, you know, my customer is everyone out there. That's not a good way to move forward.
Well, that example brings up a question and a problem that I know exists for a lot of people. I've seen it myself. And that is, you can do research on the internet. For example, should you have Amazon fulfill your orders and ship your products, or should you do it yourself? Should you create physical products or digital products if you're selling information? And you can find people arguing both sides of the case and leave you paralyzed, not really knowing, well, what should I do?
Right. Well, maybe the best way is, I mean, that's absolutely true. Maybe the best approach is to go back to where we started the conversation. Don't necessarily, you know, watch all these videos about where my business idea is going to come from. Let's start with you. You know, you as an individual, you are good at something. Everyone is an expert at something. And I think that's the key, rather than going out and acquiring a ton of new skills. You know, ultimately, the key is transferring your knowledge that you already have. The woman who is baking the sourdough bread, you know, ultimately she learned about technology. Ultimately, she learned about marketing. But the main thing was this personality and her desire to teach, you know, her love of baking and so on. That's what made that a success, not whatever she learned later, you know, by watching YouTube.
It would seem that if you're going to start a side hustle, there are some things, even if you're starting small, there are some things you're going to need to get started. You're going to need a logo. You're going to probably need a website. You're going to need email marketing and some email provider. That there's a list of things that you're going to need that for some people is overwhelming or a lot to do on your own.
Man, you start with the minimum. You start with, like, what is the basics? You don't actually need, like, all of that stuff. I mean, maybe you do need a website. Maybe you do need an email marketing list, et cetera. But, you know, you don't necessarily need to be active on 15 different social networks, which is what a lot of people try to do and fail. I mean, you're not going to be able to do that. So just to take that one example of, like, social media, I always encourage people to mostly be active on two. Like, pick two networks. And, like, well, which ones do I pick? Well, which ones do your ideal customers use the most? You know, if that's Instagram, then you should be on Instagram. If it's something else, then be there. So I think the process of elimination is really powerful in making these decisions, especially for people who have day jobs and they've already got their 40 hours a week, you know, planned out. They've got a family, perhaps, other responsibilities. So since they're trying to do this on limited time, they have to really make that time effective. And one of the ways you can be effective is by stripping away all this extraneous stuff and saying, what do I actually need to do to go from idea to offer, put this out in the world, get the information that I need so that I can then determine what to do next.
The examples you've been talking about so far are individuals. And I'm wondering, I can imagine people saying, well, you know, I'm going to do this with my best friend or, you know, somebody who can do things that I can't, that has a talent that I don't have. What about doing this as a partnership?
I've profiled some stories with partnerships, so they can be successful. But I would say all things being equal, unless you have a really compelling reason to have a partnership, like you both have the same dream, but you have different skills, you kind of work together, then that's good. Unless you have a compelling reason, don't do that. Do it on your own. Because for every story that I featured of a successful partnership, there are so many more of, you know, a story that just features one person, but it began as a partnership. And what happens along the way, almost inevitably, not 100%, but pretty often, is one person ends up being more committed to the idea than the other. And so how do you then navigate that, right? So I would say, you know, all things being equal, you can still get help, you can still get advice, you can still involve other people, but actually forming it as a legal partnership should be something that only happens for a really special reason.
Obviously, success is a great reward and a great motivator, but what do you find when you talk to people who do this? What's the first thing? What's the thing that is the first big reward that really propels them forward and makes them glad they did this?
To me, honestly, even small amounts of money can be empowering and validating to people. So for anybody listening, like if you know, your whole life you've gotten a paycheck and then all of a sudden you start one of these little side projects and you know, you wake up, you know, a month from now and you have a PayPal notification or a Venmo notification that a stranger sent you money, it feels really, really good. I mean, I'm telling these stories on book tour and like I can ask the audience who has a side hustle and probably like, you know, a third of the audience raises their hand. And then of those people, I say, do you remember the first time you got paid? And probably about half of those people like have a specific memory of years ago, the first time they got this payment. So I want to encourage people to get to that point as quickly as possible. Don't worry necessarily about whether it's going to make, you know, a huge amount of money or be a huge success. Honestly, getting that first $100 payment or whatever it is can feel really good, and it can lead you to something beyond that.
Well, I really like this. I'm such a proponent of this idea, and I know so many people who have done it. One of my favorite examples is a woman who I knew who, what she would do is she would take the bride's bouquet from the wedding, and she had this ability, this artistic ability to take those flowers, and she had a special technique to press them into a flat picture, into a frame that looked like the original bouquet, and it was gorgeous. And she would do it when she wanted. She basically would turn the switch on when she wanted to make some money and turn it off when she didn't. And she did. She made quite a bit of money. It's such a great idea, what you're talking about. I really appreciate you sharing it. Chris Guillebeau has been my guest. He is the host of the Side Hustle Podcast. It's a daily podcast where every day he features another person who has done a successful side hustle. And he is author of the book, 100 Side Hustles, Unexpected Ideas for Making Money Without Quitting Your Day Job. And there's a link to his book and to his podcast in the show notes. Thanks, Chris.
Awesome. Thank you. I appreciate it, man.
One thing we all have experience with is the weather. I'm sure there have been times in your past when you counted on a weather forecast that did not come true. It rained when it wasn't supposed to, or it didn't snow when you were told it would, or it was supposed to be a hot and sunny day, and it turned out to be a cloudy and dreary day. So clearly, forecasting the weather is not an exact science, but it is a science, and how that science works and has evolved is really interesting and definitely worth understanding. Andrew Blum is a journalist who's written a couple of books. His first book, Tubes, was out a couple of years ago, and he was a guest here, and I always remember that, Andrew, because I remember how you talked about the smell of the internet, that the internet actually has a smell. It was really a fascinating discussion, and you can hear it in episode number 83, which was back in July of 2017. You can just go to the website, somethingyoushouldknow.net, and find that episode. Andrew's new book is called The Weather Machine, A Journey Inside the Forecast. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
So are we, generally speaking, pretty good at forecasting the weather, do you think?
We're actually very good at it. And I know some people don't love to hear that because you know, they might have gotten caught in the rain recently. But the numbers that meteorologists like to rightfully brag about are that their forecasts have gotten better by about a decade over the last 50 years, which is to say that a 5-day forecast today is as good as a 4-day forecast was 10 years ago, is as good as a 3-day forecast 20 years ago, or most staggeringly, as good as a 1-day forecast was 40 years ago. And, you know, it's not always perfect, of course. And I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, our willingness to hear when a meteorologist says maybe, you know, says it might rain or it might not. We don't like that uncertainty, but uncertainty can actually in itself be a good forecast. So it's the age of the weatherman being wrong half the time is entirely over.
It doesn't always seem like it, though, does it?
I think a lot of it is there's a bit of a lag in how much the app makers and how much meteorologists are willing to sort of trust us with a forecast that says maybe, you know, because there are days where it's definitely not going to rain. There are days where it definitely is going to rain. And then there are days where it's going to rain and it's not going to rain. And, you know, the minute by minute prediction of that, it might be beyond the realm of technology. It might be sort of beyond their ability. But we also have to consider it might be beyond our usefulness, because a forecast is only as good as how you can act on it. That's a sort of truism of meteorologists. It's not just the moment to moment, this is what's going to happen, but what decisions can we make from it?
And this may be a case of you tend to notice when things go wrong more than when they go right. But I had the experience of living in the Northeast in Connecticut for a period of 6 years. Between 2004 and 2010. And every winter, it seemed, there would be some forecast of some big snowstorm in southern Connecticut. And they were predicting, 4 to 6 inches, 8 to 12 inches. And it almost never was. It just seems like, anyway, that it almost never was. There was no snow, or there was a little snow that turned into rain, or it snowed a little bit and there was maybe an inch of snow, but there was never, it seems like there was never 12 inches of snow. It seemed the forecast was always over-predicting and under-delivering.
Yeah, snow's tough, particularly in this part of the world, in the Northeast, because often it might snow, 2 inches on the coast and 20 miles away, it might snow 6 inches up in the hills. And that matters a lot to you. That's a big difference. But what I've seen over the last few years is, it'll say, it might snow. It's going to snow in this band, 4 days from now, starting at this hour and finishing at this hour. And you can see the drift in the weather maps and in the snow accumulation maps. They might be off by 10 miles, by 20 miles, which in the context of days, in the context of the planet, is really nothing. In the context of, were you able to get out of your driveway? I understand certainly is a big deal. But it's interesting. I just think there's a bit of real lag between what our technology, the technology the forecast has given us, and our willingness to say, okay, I understand it's going to snow, but I understand that this is the band of uncertainty. This is what I can't quite know. And I frankly have to be prepared for both possibilities. And that's as much a kind of social science issue as it is a weather forecasting or meteorology issue.
So take me on a little journey here of where the idea came from, where somebody said, let's try to predict what's going to happen and how that evolved.
Yeah, it's a great story. I mean, the first thing that has to happen is you need telecommunications. The first thing you need is the telegraph, because you can't begin to think about what the weather is going to be in different times if you don't know what the weather is in many places at the same time. So it's the first step is kind of having being able to draw a weather map of simultaneous conditions all over the place. And for that, you need some way to communicate faster than the weather itself. So that's kind of ingredient number one is the telegraph in the 1840s and 1850s. Ingredient number two comes from a Norwegian meteorologist, a guy named Wilhelm Bjerknes. And at the turn of the century, most famous paper published in 1904, he said these equations of physics can actually predict the evolution of the atmosphere and the creation of weather. And he had no way to calculate those equations, and he wasn't entirely right, but he was pretty close. But the key thing that he did, and he was right enough about, was that if you could write an equation, if you could put it in math, then you can prove clearly, very clearly, each day if you were right or if you were wrong. So he kind of made a way of having a sort of turning the weather into a kind of science experiment. And as soon as that happened, you could begin to refine those equations, month by month, year by year. And as a result of sort of that insight that the weather is a kind of daily science experiment, the weather forecast is a daily science experiment, by the time we had computers and satellites in the 1960s and 1970s, this started to work. And in the 40 years since, it's gotten better step by step, because not only can you sort of refine the equations each day and sort of see if they worked better the next day, but you can go back and you can test your new equations against all of the past weather that you have on record of the past 10 or 20 years. And it's really that step by step iteration, but using, you know, the real equations of physics of the atmosphere that has led to this more remarkable forecast, or really this course of improvement that's been remarkable.
Then shouldn't it be the case that as time goes by, and maybe this is the case, that as time goes by and we have more history, it should become more accurate?
It utterly is the case. The statistic that the weather modelers flaunt, which is that they have improved their skill, which is to say their ability to predict the weather better than just sort of looking at what the weather was that day a year ago, one day farther into the future with each passing decade, is really the sort of metric that they point to say that to indicate that their improvement has really been consistent. And that's actually been accelerating. The sort of best weather model in the world comes from the European Center for Medium Range Weather Forecasts, which is in Reading, England, and is it's made up a consortium of scientists from sort of all of the European weather offices, the government weather offices. And one of the things, you know, that it's kind of a Top Gun outfit. Their sort of single dedication is to making a better global weather model. And global weather models are important because those are the weather models that you need to predict farther out into the future, because the atmosphere is moving around over the course of days. And so that's really the place that has been the most successful in improving their forecast, month after month, year after year. And they're actually increasing the rate at which those improvements are happening, rather than a decade of increased skill. You know, meaning we can predict the weather better than just looking at what the climate says it's going to be, to the point where they think they can get to 14 days in the next 10 years. So not just a skillful 5-day forecast, but really yet another sort of quantum leap with better supercomputing power, with better satellites, with better physics and better equations and better algorithms, and better methods of testing those to really sort of bring us to an entirely new point in the weather forecast.
Well, that's the thing, right? I remember hearing that, you know, predicting the weather for tomorrow is pretty easy. 3 days out, it gets a little tougher. A week out, it's starting to get really difficult. And 14 days out, it's almost 50-50.
And, you know, the amazing thing, though, is that, you know, if the 3-day forecast is as good as the 2-day forecast was 10 years ago, that's a pretty significant improvement. I mean, I started working on this book, Sandy, was 7 years ago is when I first looked at it. So to think that based on the sort of statistical benchmarks that the weather modelers use to measure the success of their models, to think that just in that 7 years, you know, it's almost a day of improvement in how far into the future they're able to be skillful, I think is a, you know, really sort of remarkable success story about a global infrastructure, and I should point out as well, a public infrastructure. This is not the creation of any single private corporation. It's really about the sort of cooperation of scientists all over the world.
Something I think is really important, and I'd like to get a handle on, because I don't really understand this. Is the weather ever unpredictable? Can a hurricane turn left instead of right, and there's no way to know that it's just an act of God kind of thing? Or is it just that we don't have the technology, or someone made a mistake? In other words, does the weather sometime have a mind of its own and there's no way to tell what it's going to do?
Well, it's an interesting question. Yeah, there's a bit of a cone. You know, did the weather turn, or was the forecast wrong? You know, we can only look into the future in one direction. And I think the thing to recognize is that it's really about when you talk about what's going to happen if the forecast is wrong, you're talking about when is it wrong? Is it wrong 2 days ahead of time? Is it wrong 3 days ahead of time? Is it wrong 6 hours ahead of time? Is it wrong 10 minutes ahead of time? And one of the things that's been interesting with the way the weather models work is you can begin to see a sort of convergence of forecasts among the sort of competing weather models and competing systems. If they're all saying the same thing, pretty likely that's going to happen. And sometimes, you know, at 2 days or at 1 day, there's a surprise where actually it turns out the models were wrong. And you know, I remember that I think it was one of the Florida hurricanes a few years ago, that the expectation was that it was going to go up the east coast of Florida and it went up the west coast. And that was a big deal. That was a big mistake. But it was really about the decision that was made 4 days before rather than the forecast that came 2 days before. And this adjustment to sort of knowing how to deal, you know, when to make decisions based on how confident we can be in a given forecast. You know, this is an adjustment that has to be made by governors, by emergency managers. And I think it really behooves meteorologists and weather modelers to be able to communicate how sure they are of a certain forecast, you know, how sure they are of the outputs of their models.
How does it work that we have these computer models that examine what is going on, what's happened in the past, and then therefore what's likely to happen into the future? Does someone take that data, does some human take that data and interpret it, or does the computer say partly cloudy and a chance of showers?
First, I want to clarify one thing you pointed out there, that it's these computer models are not taking the weather statistics or weather experience of the past and sort of extrapolating what might happen in the future based on what happened in the past. They're actually sort of deeper in the atmosphere than that. They're really about the physical equations of how moisture and heat and cool are moving through the atmosphere. They go back to really thermodynamics, which means that when there have been moments where we've had some weather that is unprecedented, for example, Hurricane Harvey in Houston a few years ago, the models spit out astounding rain totals that every meteorologist said this would be unheard of. This has never happened. You know, I can't imagine this would be the case. And it was the case because the models don't have that kind of human bias of what hasn't happened in the past won't happen in the future. Now, to answer the other part of your question, I think, the models produce outputs, and it is the job of human meteorologists to interpret those outputs. But we're at an interesting sort of threshold with that, because while certainly, especially in predicting impacts and saying, oh, well, if the sleet's going to happen, then, you know, I know that the, you know, I-95 is going to be a mess. You know, that's still the job of humans. But I've observed over the last few years that there are often cases where the best weather models are second-guessed by human meteorologists who are kind of going on gut instinct, who perhaps haven't really come to terms with the success of these weather models.
Maybe an example would be a better way to answer this question. But when you talk about, you know, equations and the laws of thermodynamics and moisture and all that, it sounds very, very scientific. And an equation is A plus B equals C. There's mm-hmm. not like A plus B might equal C, and or it's there's a 50% chance of C. It's A plus B equals C. So when A plus B doesn't equal C in the weather, what typically, or just as an example, where does the divergence happen?
That's a great question. I think the crux of it is our ability to know what the weather is as the starting point for knowing what the weather will be. And so, of course, when we observe the atmosphere, when that observation is absolutely imperfect. We not only do we not measure in every molecule, but we sort of have a we choose a places to observe the atmosphere. We might have a weather station every 20 miles. We might have a polar orbiting satellite that is that is in a low Earth orbit and is using its entire suite of sensors to collect different observations. But perhaps, you know, it's only orbiting, its complete orbit might take 12 hours. And so, you know, the observations from one point might be older than the observations from another point. So I guess part of the weather modelers really hold dear is that their equations aren't wrong, but their observations of the atmosphere might not be quite precise enough. And so that disconnect between our ability to know what the weather is in order to know what the weather will be has been the kind of bugaboo for modelers for basically a century. And one of the things that's made the weather forecast better is that our ability to know the present state of the atmosphere, as they say, to know what the atmosphere is doing at this moment, has improved dramatically, particularly with the satellites that offer global coverage. You know, 40 years ago, when there weren't satellites over the southern hemisphere, it was very hard to make get a good forecast several days in advance because you didn't have a picture of the entire Earth's atmosphere. You only had the places where the weather was observed, and you know, not only in the northern hemisphere, but really only over land. And so it's really sort of that extra observation that's one of the key legs of the stool that allows for then a better prediction forward in time. It's not that the equations are wrong. It's that we don't really know quite what to put into them.
So I wonder, is it the case that certain kinds of weather or certain places in the world are more or less difficult to forecast? Is winter weather easier to predict than summer weather? Is Australian weather really tricky? Is weather?
No, I think there are definitely places in the world that are easier to forecast than others. That said, though, because of these new capabilities particularly the weather satellites, and the weather satellites have really been the key to the whole system in terms of improving forecasts, because they do provide a uniform coverage of the Earth. It's not just about, you know, at LaGuardia Airport where there's a weather station, or it's not just about, you know, the dense network of stations over wealthier nations as opposed to over poorer nations. It really is the satellites that have brought a kind of a cohesion, a kind of equality to the way that they look at the atmosphere.
Well, and you just brought up like San Diego, you know, the weather's the weather. It's pretty much the same all the time. It rains once in a while, but is it the case that extreme weather is particularly difficult to forecast compared to sunny 75 degree weather?
I think it's the stakes for the forecast are certainly higher. But one of the things that the models have really sort of proven their amazing worth with is for our, frankly, new weather regime. You know, we are. You know, every meteorologist will acknowledge that we are living in a new age of weather. That this is, you know, things are doing. You know, the weather is doing strange things. Storms are bigger. Temperatures are more extreme. And as that happens, it's not about, you know, the meteorologist recalling, you know, what had happened in the past, and it's not about their instinct or their intuition based on the data at hand. It really does put more weight on the capabilities of the weather models to go deeper into the atmosphere to calculate hundreds of millions of observations, and to do that with regularity in a way that proves their worth every single day. That has sort of brought us into a new age of forecasting for a new age of weather.
Will the future of weather forecasting eliminate things like, you know, there's a 50% chance of rain? Because, you know, what do you do with that? It might rain, it might not rain. Yeah, I could have told you that. But will we get to the point where we're not giving probabilities, but that we'll really know?
See, I think it already has, which is so interesting. I mean, it's certainly quite a regular occurrence for school districts to close schools before the snow even starts. And that's something that would have never happened 10 or 20 years ago, because there wasn't enough confidence in the prediction. Now, of course, if you get burned, and this happens occasionally, where you say it's definitely going to snow 12 inches, you got to close the schools, and then it doesn't happen, then that's a problem. But the thing that everyone's honing in on together, both the people who make the decisions and the people who make the forecasts and the people who make the models, is at what, you know, when do you pull the trigger? At what point is this sort of converging lines of confidence and the need to make a decision? At what point do they come together? You know, we had a storm in New York this winter where school was closed, the night before. And it didn't snow much. And I had actually seen the meteorologists looking at the most recent outputs of the models saying, you know, things are trending a little bit less, you know, 12 hours, you know, it's 12 hours out. And we actually don't think this is going to be as bad as it was. But that information hadn't yet been sort of hadn't made it up the chain to the mayor. And the decision was already made to close the schools.
So clearly, as you've discussed, time is a huge factor in predicting the weather. You know, predicting tomorrow's weather is pretty easy. Predicting the weather 2 weeks out is pretty tough. But as we get closer to that day, the predictions become more and more accurate. Andrew Blum has been my guest. He's a journalist and author of the book, The Weather Machine, A Journey Inside the Forecast. And there's a link to his book in the show notes. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Mike. This is great. I appreciate it.
You know, from the time we are children, we have a tendency as humans to be more trusting of attractive people and less trusting of ugly people. And as we get older, that tendency gets stronger, particularly in females. This is according to a study published in the journal Frontiers of Psychology. This is further evidence that supports something called the beauty stereotype. This describes the phenomenon whereby more attractive people are also considered smarter and more sociable and more successful. Other research has shown that attractive people are treated better by their peers and preferred by newborn babies, and now we can add trustworthiness to the list. While we try not to judge a book by its cover, it seems that when it comes to sizing up people, it's just something we do. We're born with a tendency, and it only increases with age. And that is something you should know.
And now that the episode is over, what better time than to leave a rating and review of Something You Should Know on Apple Podcasts. I'm Mike Carruthers. Thanks for listening today to Something You Should Know.